This is The Guardian.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
The government is once again worried about China and a new cyber attack aimed at MPs and, it seems, millions of us.
I mean, it represents an epoch-defining challenge and also the greatest state-based threat to our economic security.
Just to be clear, as far as anyone knows, all this doesn't involve seagulls. Anyway, why is the Chinese state even doing this? And why won't the UK label the country a major threat? Meanwhile, there's the latest instalment of the Tories' steady march to victory.
Rishi Sunak has been forced to carry out a mini reshuffle of his team after two government ministers resigned.
Remember, there's only 7 more months of this to go. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are The Guardian's foreign lead writer Tanya Branigan and The Guardian's deputy political editor Peter Walker. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Right, let's talk about China. On Monday, the government sanctioned two people and a company in China for a cyber attack on MPs and the Electoral Commission back in 2022. Let's have a listen to the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, making a statement in Parliament.
I can confirm today that Chinese state-affiliated actors were responsible for two malicious cyber campaigns targeting both our democratic institutions and parliamentarians. First, the compromise of the United Kingdom Electoral Commission between 2021 and 2022, which was announced last summer. And second, attempted reconnaissance activity against UK parliamentary accounts in a separate campaign in 2021.
Now, he said that a branch of the Chinese state called Advanced Persistent Threat Group 31, this just reads like something from a dystopian sci-fi novel somewhat, was behind attempts to access details of MPs critical of Beijing, as well as the names and addresses of up to 40 million voters. Now, Rishi Sunak said this week that, quote, China represents the greatest state-based threat to our economic security, unquote. He has also described China in the same breath as an epoch-defining challenge. Now, both of those forms of words fall short of what some MPs, Tory MPs in particular, want, which is for China to be designated an official threat. In all the reporting I've read, it's very unclear what the Chinese state actually have on people, institutions, MPs, and so on. One of the things it said that has been accessed is the electoral roll, for example, which is no great prize. You can go on 192.com
which and buy slightly, a subscription. Slightly cheaper, wouldn't it?
No, exactly. It's not a big, shining espionage haul. So what's going on here, Tanya? What information have they got and why have they got it?
Well, I agree. I mean, the electoral roll is rather curious since it's available by more legitimate and, as you say, easier means anyway. I think one theory is it's a kind of practice for seeing what can be amassed within UK institutional systems. Another thing, of course, is that Chinese intelligence gathering has often been very, very broad brush. It's about hoovering up huge quantities of information as much as it is about specific targets. And so you amass a large amount of information in the hope that it sort of becomes useful somewhere along the line. But I think obviously the fact that it's something that is to do with elections and democracy makes people feel inherently nervous, understandably, about it.
So is there an implied prospect or possibility in this bit of news about something much, much more worrying and potentially damaging, therefore sort of opening up as a possibility?
I think at the moment, it seems as if people are concerned by the context more than what's actually happened. So the fact it's the Electoral Commission rather than the fact it specifically opens the door to a new threat as such. I'd say the more concerning aspects this week are the targeting of individuals. There's obviously been a lot of focus on the targeting of critics in terms of MPs and so forth who've been critical of China. But most important, I would say, by a country mile, is the fact that we know that China does pursue information and tries to intrude into the communications of dissidents, exiles. So Uyghur human rights activists, people who've been in Hong Kong and have ended up fleeing. And that is the one that's really concerning, because those are people who are clearly much more vulnerable.
Peter, you were nodding as Tanya said that, specifically about MPs who have a track record of calling out the Chinese state and the Chinese government and so on. So is it your sense that there's an anxious atmosphere among that kind of MP at the moment in the wake of this news?
I think it's a bit of a mixture. Some MPs almost take it as a badge of pride that they've been sanctioned by China and China is going after them. But it's a very intimidating thing, the fact that you know almost for certain the Chinese state is going to be trying to hack into your IT and look for secrets. There are even some rumours of some people connected to this having relatives who live in Hong Kong or other places facing problems, for example, with bank accounts and stuff like that. It's very broad, and understandably, the MPs don't really like to speak about it that much. But it just generally creates this atmosphere where the implicit message is, look, if you put your head, you know, above the parapet and go after us, then we'll go after you. And that could put some people off.
Given the noise that's been made about this, Tanya, what form of retaliation do you think the UK might receive from the Chinese government?
Well, they've certainly been very quick to say that, of course, this is not their doing at all, that China is much more sinned against than sinning. They're the chief victim of cyber attacks and so forth. I mean, I think it partly depends on how far the UK goes. And you'd have to say these sanctions feel slightly token, if I can put it that way. And that really sort of fits a broader pattern if you think about our response on Hong Kong, for example. You could argue that we're the sort of the chief interlocutor there, not just because we were the colonial power before handover, but that we have a special responsibility. We agreed the terms of the handover through a binding bilateral international treaty. And yet the sanctions that we've imposed over Hong Kong have been pretty minimal compared to the sanctions that, say, the US has put in place. So I think one of the sort of the key things to think about is really the international context and the way that there has been a deterioration of relations between China and the US particularly, and China and the West. And the UK is very much keeping an eye on what others have done. So one of the striking things about this week, it's not that any of this hacking is especially new, but there was obviously a coordinated attempt to address it because you saw the US, the UK and New Zealand, which is another member of the Five Eyes Anglophone intelligence sharing community, putting out these statements at the same time about them being targeted.
I mean, here's a sort of big question. Clearly, economically, we are very, very wrapped up with China. Chinese companies invest in a lot of the British economy and British infrastructure. We do a lot of trade with China. How does that sit in the midst of all this? It's not like in the Cold War, supermarkets were full of products made in the Soviet Union, right? That's the situation we're faced with. In fact, that's only one small part of it, the role of Chinese manufacturers in the consumer economy. It runs much deeper and wider than that. If people are pushing for China to be designated a threat, and the Prime Minister is saying that China represents the greatest state-based threat to our economic security, where does that sit in the midst of the extent to which our economies are intertwined? It feels strange.
Well, it feels uncomfortable, doesn't it? And that's why we've seen, really, in the US as well, but particularly across Europe, this rather sort of strange dance going on. You may remember there was all this talk in Europe of decoupling from China, and then it became de-risking because it was felt that decoupling was a bit too provocative and a step too far. And similarly with the UK, it's this rather odd moment where the golden relationship's over. We're prepared to talk about them being a threat in some ways, but there's clearly a sort of keenness within parts of the cabinet to stick to the sort of challenge designation, particularly when they're hoping for a massive tranche of investment from China into a big gigafactory in the West Midlands. So there's very definitely a sense that we're trying to have our cake and eat it. I think in the past, people sort of thought, it's fine, we can take what we want. It's going to be a lucrative golden relationship. We're frankly going to turn a bit of a blind eye to human rights concerns and everything else because it doesn't affect us. So you may remember George Osborne trotting off to Xinjiang and happily being shown round without voicing all the concerns about human rights that were already rearing their head there. But now we've moved to a stage where it's affecting perhaps our democracies more directly and affecting us more directly in broader ways. And then we are now prepared to say, we don't like this very much. We're not going to gloss over it anymore. But on the other hand, we're not going to do too much about it quite yet.
This sounds familiar, Peter, in the sense that, you know, you can politicians and ministers will sound off about this and strike a sort of moral tone. But in the end, money talks, really.
I mean, yes and no. This has been going on for a long time, and it's about gradual changes. And you had the Cameron-Osborne golden era or golden relationship or whatever it was they talked about it.
It seems mind-boggling looking back on it now,
having
doesn't it?
Cameron's and President Xi having a kind of cosy pint in an Oxfordshire pub.
And George Osborne taking him to Manchester Airport and showing him where they were going to build the new Amazon warehouse and all of that.
The rights abuses were taking place then. They were not new.
Well, presumably there was lots of espionage going on as well, because there would be.
But in terms of the British political thing, I think the more vocal anti-engagement with China sentiment in the Conservative Party is in the ascendancy. So I think it could actually change things. I mean, it remains to be seen that the money still talks an awful lot. But at the moment, you've got Rishi Sunak, who's trying not to take a view. You've got David Cameron, who is obviously part of that old era, who's leading the foreign relations. And there's also question marks about him that before he came back into office, he was doing some lobbying on behalf of China for this Sri Lankan port. And questions about that is very, very much not. I mean, there's all sorts of weird things about David Cameron's role that on Monday, after all this stuff came out, the only publicly facing thing he did, he gave a presentation to the 1922 Committee of Tory MPs.
He did.
So he didn't speak in the Commons, obviously, because he's a peer. So the only people who got to hear about the government's view on China from directly from him were Conservative MPs, which feels slightly unsatisfactory. So it's all, for all sorts of reasons, currently a bit of a muddle and a bit of a mess, and it remains to be seen where we go.
But we need to highlight that again. There is something very odd, isn't there, about the fact that the British politician who you most vividly associate with that era of UK-Chinese relations and the embrace of China and a blind eye being turned to various things is the Foreign Secretary at the point that all the rhetoric gets ramped up and all these things come to the surface. That's peculiar, isn't it, Tanya?
Yes, and I think it's important to say that a lot of people at the time raised questions about the strategy. It's not a case of hindsight. You know, people talk about the West being naive on China. I think what's really striking is how much wishful thinking there was, because basically people didn't care about human rights. People didn't think that the downsides were going to affect the UK.
Hold on, the window dressing was this sort of slightly naive kind of post-Cold War way of thinking on George Osborne and David Cameron's part, that this was all part of encouraging China to join the community of nations and adopt the norms of liberal democracy and so on. I mean, that's what they said. Do you think they believed it?
Well, I think if they did, they were extraordinarily stupid. I mean, that ship had long since sailed. You know, there was a moment perhaps where people believed that was really going to happen, but certainly by about sort of 2011, 2012, the direction things were moving in China was pretty clear. And it was towards a much more nationalistic, a much more forceful way of doing things. So as I said, I think it's quite important not to let people off the hook here, because I think they did know.
I think it's true. I mean, even if there was a politician at that time who believed, you know, well, somehow, you know, we can make this work. Somehow China is going to change because, you know, had this belief in this idea that kind of increasingly richer countries before, you know, go down this slightly more democratic liberal route. There'd been plenty of people within the Foreign Office and Number 10 who understand China who would have sat them down and told them that's not the case. Yeah. So they've got no excuse. I mean, Tanya's totally right.
But there was a huge hole to be plugged in terms of British investment and infrastructure, right?
Well, there was. And, you know, to be fair, this is not a problem that only the UK faces. Every country that has engagement with China in this way has this trade-off between the sheer economic might and the investment they can bring and then the consequences from that. So it's not a uniquely British thing. It's just we have this weird circle of having very much leapt into it under Osborne and David Cameron and then having the chief architect of this back in government and trying to pretend things are different.
And it is worth saying that China has become much more forceful over the years. What we've also seen is a knee-jerk and at times, frankly, quite xenophobic approach to China, which goes beyond the warranted concerns, I think, to tip over into a slight yellow perilism at times.
Yeah, that's a big part of Donald Trump's politics.
Yeah.
Constantly. We talked a bit about the fact that one of the focuses of the cyber attacks was the Electoral Commission and that the electoral roll is in this, which sort of then opens up a conversation about a looming election and what this may or may not tell us about Chinese involvement or not in some of that. Now, we associate disinformation and misinformation very much with the Russian state and Russian actors, in quote marks. Do you think that sort of electoral aspect of this story might say something about China and elections, potentially, along roughly the same line?
Well, it's very curious because, as you say, it's Russia who has been much more aggressive in disinformation and in very visibly sort of meddling. China hasn't really been associated with that. I mean, the concerns of the West have been much more around economic espionage. And even now, when you look at a lot of the concerns that the US is raising, for example, it's been about the long-term strategic implications of Chinese information. For example, they're trying to replace all these giant cranes at their ports because they're worried about the fact that the systems can be controlled from China. And that has potential implications not only for the American economy and trade, but even potentially in the case of war, they're starting to think what happens when you've got China being able to look at troop movements.
Yeah, the political interference stuff, see, in my instance, I would think the Chinese state might think that was a bit grubby and unseemly and beneath it. Right?
Well, I mean, where the interference has come has been in terms of trying to shift politicians, to intimidate critics and so forth, much more than it has been around the sort of Russian-type activity where you're deliberately fomenting division and so forth. Having said that, I mean, I think that China, like Russia, sees a kind of opportunity in the West where democracy is in disarray, the idea of truth is in question thanks to Trump, that all of these things create a sense that there's much more up for grabs and that the West is generally much weaker, much more disorganized, chaotic, that you can get people on side more easily and foment divisions in a way that perhaps people didn't think was possible 15, 20 years ago.
Peter, this is an argument, I suppose, because they're in government, which one thinks of in political terms as happening among conservatives, right? But obviously, the chances are, in fact, if John Curtis, the political scientist, is to be believed, it's now 99% certain that we're going to get a Labour government. Where's the Labour Party here? What's your sense of that?
I don't think they've necessarily made their minds up. There are some splits on this, as there are in every party. My sense is that overall, they'll be leaning less towards a kind of Cameronite golden era. I mean, partly because that moment has passed. But at the same time, you know, they're economically realistic and they know that you can't do anything drastic, that we just completely cut off the tap of Chinese funds. So I think it remains to be seen. And I think thus far they've managed to keep the debate below the surface. But, you know, obviously once you get into government, that never lasts.
It'll be just as delicate a walk for them as it is for the current government. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. First thing to say goodbye to Tanya. Thank you for joining us.
Goodbye.
When we come back, we will be asking Peter for an end-of-term report card with Easter looming about how Labour and the Conservatives are doing.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes Monday and Thursdays.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back. It's the Easter holidays, or the absolute cusp of them, and MPs have already left Westminster for a 20-day break. It's a nice life, isn't it? So we thought we'd give the Conservatives and the Labour Party some kind of end-of-term report. Peter, you're there most days. What's it like in Westminster at the minute? I ask you that because we talked last week on the podcast about a zombie parliament, the idea there's not much going on. Working hours at Westminster are sort of dwindling. I wonder whether it feels like being at university and staying on beyond the end of term, you know, as the halls of residence became quieter and quieter and quieter, and you started to wonder what you were doing there.
I mean, I think in defence of MPs, it's worth pointing out that Westminster is just one aspect of their work, and even over Easter, they'll be doing a lot of local work. And to be honest, that's the bigger and arguably more important part of the job that they do. So they're not doing nothing, but it is very true that Westminster feels like it's winding down. Even in the lead up towards the Easter recess, you were noticing at the end of last week, fewer and fewer MPs around. Everything in Westminster is always set by what the governing party is doing. They kind of set the mood. And at the moment, Conservative MPs are going through one of their slightly kind of quieter, lying down in a darkened room periods where they're not openly plotting. And it...
What, they're just quietly plotting?
Well, they're thinking about what to do next. I mean, you know, to be completely honest, some know that they're going to lose and they're just looking for other jobs.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of those. But the ones who are still engaged with it, there was this big flurry of, is it Penny Mordaunt? Is it this? Is it that? That's, you know, A, can be generated by only a very small number of people. But B, what there was has very much died down. I think people now are just waiting for the local and mayoral elections on 2nd of May. They've decided they're going to have a break, stop troubling their brain with it, and come back to it then.
Now, every week, maybe even every day, it feels like something happens as regards the sort of internal state of the Conservative Party. And this week, it's been the resignations of two Tory ministers, Robert Halfen and James Heapy, have both quit their positions. Very telling, actually, both of those resignations, in the sense that they are loyalists, they're not troublemakers, who were really, really respected by a lot of their colleagues, and they've gone, right? And a lot has been read into that. From your perspective, what does it tell us?
In one sense, it's a reasonably standard thing. You're getting near to an election. Both of them have been in Parliament a reasonable amount of time. There is an argument that if you're going to stand out as an MP at the next election, you don't know when the election is, that it's better to give up your ministerial job because you can't commit fully to it. But to be completely honest, that doesn't happen every time. It's a deliberate choice. And these were two of the people who, in Conservative terms, quietly got on with their jobs, were no trouble for the PM, were respected by almost all MPs. And it's a real loss. And we're now at the stage where the total number of Conservative MPs who've said they're going to step down is 63. And if you add in the people who were Conservatives but have lost the whip and are going to stand down, you're now up to 20% of the entire 2019 contingent are not going to be there. And in historical terms, we've had bigger turnovers. But we've got an election, it's still potentially 6 or 7 months away. There's a lot more who could still go. And it's very much a sense of people thinking, we're going to be out of power for a while, I'm going to go and do something else. Or just, you know, I've had enough, I can't take it anymore.
Particularly in the case of these two, because there's no other agenda at work, right? That's what that tells you.
I think there is. Neither of them were going to be standing for leader or actively plotting for anyone else. They don't necessarily have a stake in it. If you are used to being a minister and you have the prospect of at least 5 years in opposition, you know, having minimal media time, minimal interest, just getting on with your constituency work. For some people, that's fine. I mean, I was speaking to a minister the other week. I actually asked them, you know, are you part of the bunch you're going to go? And they got really annoyed. And they said, why are you asking me that? Is that because I'm, you know, a certain age? I was going, no, it's just because everyone's quitting. It's almost got to the stage where someone's, if they've been in the cabinet and, you know, they've been in parliament for more than about 15 years, you just assume that they're off.
Right. Another thing that's happened in Tory world this week is that Jonathan Gullis, the Stoke-on-Trent MP, has taken the job of Conservative deputy chairman, which was once held by Lee Anderson, who's now Reform's only MP. This is all very, very complicated. Somebody said to me on Twitter last night, this is a bit like when the Roman Emperor Caligula made his horse a Roman consul. Like, how, where have we got in the Conservative hierarchy that Jonathan Gullis has got a gig?
I think this is slightly unfair. Jonathan Gullis...
Ha-ha! You're a Gullis champion.
I'm going to defend him because he has a pugnacious approach and he can sometimes have a tendency to be used slightly as a rent-a-quote for some of the right-wing papers. But he's genuinely quite thoughtful. And I mean,
that's the reverse of his reputation. He's seen as being a sort of attack dog.
He likes doing all that stuff. And he very much has been for a long time seen on the right wing of the party. He was very strongly pro Liz Truss. He served as schools minister for however many days it was, 49 days. And he was not seen as a natural Sunak ally. So in a sense, I actually think this appointment is a reasonably clever thing. We first got wind of it last week when Rishi Sunak addressed the 1922 Committee of Backbench MPs. This was this kind of rallying call where it was seen it was quite kind of crucial for him. And there's almost always a Conservative MP who's told to brief the media afterwards. And Jonathan Gullis suddenly turned up and gave this almost evangelical thing about how Rishi had wowed the room and everyone was going off with a spring in their step and people need to stop being childish and, you know, back him properly. And everyone's thinking, well, hang on, is this the same Jonathan Gullis or has he got a kind of twin brother? But he's now slightly in that unofficial Lee Anderson, Red Wall whisperer role. And I think it's probably better than Lee Anderson because Lee Anderson was someone who couldn't do an interview without saying something genuinely
stupid.
It'll
be less accident prone, right?
And I think it shows the right of the party. It's quite a good signal to say there are people on the right who you might look to be sending in letters of no confidence who actually back him.
In our conversation a few moments ago, you mentioned the May local elections inevitably a couple of times. There is this sense of waiting for that, right? That something quite convulsive or another quite convulsive thing will happen to the Conservative Party in the wake of those local elections. Now joined, let's not forget, as well by the Blackpool South by-election, right? So you must have a sense that that's there. We're waiting for that and something quite dramatic could happen.
It remains to be seen. I mean, the expectations for the Conservatives are not good. There's also a whole series of mayoral elections. There's a London one that Sadiq Khan is expected to win. Slightly more problematic for the Conservatives is they hold the Tees Valley one under Ben Houchen and the West Midlands under Andy Street. And I was speaking to Professor Tony Travers, who's the LSC local government guru, last week. And he was saying that there's going to be 10 mayoral elections in all, four of which exist and six of which are new ones. He's saying it's pretty unlikely, but it's not impossible for the Conservatives to lose all 10. So if Conservative MPs wake up on the 3rd of May and they've lost half their councillors, they've lost Blackpool South and they don't have any of the Metro mayors, then that could be when they start getting twitchy and their fingers hover the keypad to do a letter of no confidence. If they hold on to, you know, the West Midlands and Tees Valley, then they can claim it as a good night.
Another thing that's made a bit of noise Tory-wise this week is an attack ad against Sadiq Khan released by Conservative Central Office, based on the somewhat specious and very camped-up idea that London was now a crime hotspot, and also that the Labour Party, or Sadiq Khan, was on the verge of employing a sort of Gestapo to enforce the ultra-low emissions zone.
1945 elections.
Very much like that. Let's hear a bit of that.
London, a city steeped in history. But tonight, its ancient streets bear witness to a different tale. A tale not of kings and queens, but of crime and desperation. It is a city now run by the Labour Party, its police answer to them. It is a blueprint for how Labour intend to run the rest of the country, if you let them. In the depths of these narrow passageways tread squads of ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered with masks, terrorizing communities at the beck and call of their labor mayor master.
Now, we should make it clear there was a big issue with this video, which was that they were using footage from the New York subway, and so the ad had to be taken down, altered, and put back up. The Tories' get-out, I suppose, is they'll say, oh, this is kind of comedy value and it's all camped up and so on. But sight unseen, there's also something quite sinister about that in terms of its messaging, isn't there?
It's quite Trumpian.
Yeah.
And, you know, it basically says a lot of things which simply aren't true.
Yeah, like Sadiq Khan seized power.
Where he seized power, this idea that these masked enforcers of the ULEZ zone. ULEZ is enforced by cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and if you put a mask over a camera, it doesn't work very well.
But it's a strong Tory tradition, this, as I think you mentioned a moment ago. Winston Churchill famously in the campaign for the 1945 election said that if the Labour Party was going to implement its programme, it would need some sort of Gestapo, right? It's the same sort of tone. But in the age of online misinformation and memes and social media and all the rest of it, it does have a much more sort of sinister feel about it and the sense that we're going to get more of this, right?
I think there's two elements to it, one of which is when it comes to London mayoral elections, because they know they have minimal chance of winning quite often, the Conservatives sometimes do quite nasty. You had the 2016 mayoral election where Sadiq Khan was against Zach Goldsmith.
Yeah, yeah.
And Zach Goldsmith's campaign was openly racist. There's no other way of putting it. And it's gone down in electoral history. It's probably the most racist campaign for about 40 years.
But it's not really... I get the sense this isn't a London thing. They're using London and Sadiq Khan, right, as a kind of scary thing to wave in front of their voters elsewhere and say, if you want to understand the Labour Party, think of it as being diverse and multicultural and all those things London is in this very, very sinister way.
Right? I think it's true. And the people have told me that this was an attack ad done entirely by Conservative headquarters and that Susan Hall's people didn't know anything about it and were not very pleased.
It's nothing to do with the London election, I don't think.
No. And also, apparently, they're quite peeved because they think it makes them look bad. It's fundamentally quite weird, if you're the governing party, to be sending out a video saying that the UK's capital city, this kind of magnet for tourism, investment, everything, is a crime-ridden hellhole which you don't want to go to.
Now, the Labour Party is in the reverse of that position in the sense that it feels it's got a lot to lose, chiefly forming its first government in God knows how long. Let's just talk about them for a minute. Following interventions from Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, in the Sunday Times, let's not forget while we're on the subject of Peter Mandelson, that he's the chairman of a huge corporate consultancy firm called Global Council. He has been making sort of sceptical noises about what Labour Party people call the New Deal for workers, which they say will be one of the most transformative things it does when it's in government. And I suppose you can pick up a low hubbub of conversation about whether the New Deal for workers might be watered down, somewhat jettisoned, you know, the next victim of Labour's nervousness after the $28 billion Green Prosperity Plan. Just to make this a bit clearer, the New Deal for workers, as far as we know, will include things like banning zero contracts and fire and rehire. The Labour Party will bring in the right to switch off from work. It will update trade union legislation so, as they put it, it's fit for a modern economy. It's quite a big deal, this. Do you get the sense it's fragile? Because Labour is looking at the 6 or 7 months ahead and feeling increasingly twitchy about holding things as they are and getting over the line?
My guess is I don't think this is necessarily a problem for them. I think this is Peter Mandelson freelancing in a way that's not really particularly welcome to the Labour Party. The difference between this and the $28 billion deal is that pretty much all the polling shows that this kind of stuff is popular. People don't like, you know, 0 hours contracts, and the polling on this shows that getting rid of them is seen as a good thing. And if the Conservatives push against it like they did against the minimum wage back in the day, that very much presents this split of them being on the side of the bosses, Labour on the side of the workers. But the most important thing is it doesn't actually cost any money. The only reason the Green Prosperity Plan was so watered down was because it gave the Conservatives a chance to say, if you vote Labour, then taxes will go up, borrowing will go up. And that is a very, very resonant thing which terrifies the Labour Party. Whereas experience of stuff like the minimum wage shows that, you know, they can generally get away with this kind of stuff. And if it doesn't involve, you know, a big number with a billion on it, then they should probably be fine. You know, with the caveat, my political predictions are often wrong. I think they'll stick with this.
You said a moment ago that Tory MPs were sort of metaphorically or literally having to lie down in a darkened room. As they stare into this potential sort of 6 or 7 months of zombie politics and zombie government, what's your sense of the Labour Party's collective mood?
I mean, as ever with the Labour Party, it's a mixture of kind of quiet confidence, but a lot of anxiety,
yeah,
a
really
lot of
anxious
internal bickering. I think there's two elements to it, one of which is if you have a 20-point lead in the polls, even the day before a general election, you're going to be nervous as anything because you just keep on thinking something could go wrong. What could happen? The longer it goes on, the more nervous you get. Keir Starmer's team and Rachel Reeves's team and the whole kind of leader of the opposition operation have got a very, very tight grip on everything. And Labour MPs are very wary of saying something wrong that gets them banished into the outer darkness. Losing the whip under Labour is quite an easy thing.
Yeah.
Getting it back takes months and months.
But it's hard to maintain that for 6 or 7 months in this odd atmosphere of politics not really amounting to very much and endlessly going around in circles, right? Do you remember that thing they used to have on American quiz shows? I think we did it in this country as well. It's like, not a quiz show, it's like a game show, where you have to touch a truck and keep your hand on it for as long as possible. Have you ever seen that? And it goes on for days.
Oh,
and the
like
winner
a 1930s
turns, the winner turns out to be the person who's just stood there for 3 days and managed to keep their hand on this truck and they win the truck. That's very much the Labour Party's position, actually.
I think it is, and I think it's doable because the prize is so big. And in political terms, it's all quite close. And to be completely honest, a lot of the more kind of off-piste types have already lost the whip. And I think Keir Starmer, when he took over, was surprisingly ruthless. I think the moment where he sacked Rebecca Long-Bailey as Shadow Education Secretary was quite a pivotal thing because it showed to all the people on the left he was not going to mess about. And if you stepped out of line, then that was it. And in some ways, it does add to this atmosphere, which is arguably not very creative and very much everything is led from the centre. And when you get into government, you potentially hit problems there. But as a strategy to get you over the line, probably works quite well. It's not the most exciting, certainly not the most exciting for us. Yeah,
so you get this strange sort of expectant silence, really, is where they are.
We do, and it's this very centralised thing. It's like kind of Albania in 1985, where, you know, it's all done according to a central plan, you know, without the prison camps, I should point out.
Okay, on that note, I'm visions filling my head of Tirana, capital of Albania in 1985, whether there was anyone there touching trucks for days at a time. Anyway,
well, certainly.
Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever and however you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahars and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.